If you think you can't go from politics to the divine, Carol Gold and Steve Clark are about to take you above the fray. The only agenda here is to empower you to think for yourself, ask more questions, and trust your own truth. So now, the combination talk radio has been missing. Until now, Carol Gold and Steve Clark taking you above the fray.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Above the Fray. I'm Carol Gold, and our number here is 914-803-4522. And I, of course, want to welcome my brilliant co-host, Steve Clark, to the show. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Carol.
We all know what happened today. We all know what the market did, and I'm sure there are very few shows out there, news and or podcasting, that aren't discussing the fall in the market as it relates to our dependency or connection, whichever way you look at it, with China and its economy. But we all, in a way, saw this coming, and I think there are very few people who didn't know that there was some sort of economic trouble on the horizon. And while this is probably just sticking our toe in the water compared to what's ahead of us, you know, you and I, Steve, saw this, which is one of the reasons we wrote our book, Money, How to See It, How to Get It, How to Keep It, because you and I both believe that behind the economics of it all, behind all the financial analysis, there is, in fact, the energy of money. And what you do with it, how you obtain it, in more common vernacular, the ethics, the principles, the values that you use in putting money into the marketplace, first in earning it yourself and then putting it back into the marketplace, all has an impact. And so what I think we'd like to talk about tonight, Steve, although I know you probably want to address some of the pure economics of it, given your vast experience in international markets, I think we also want to talk about, in a way, we're not promoting the book, although, you know, who would blame us for promoting our book? You can get it on Amazon. Is the principles that need to be foundational for the economy of any country. So let's start with the obvious, Steve. Is there anything you want to input around literally the economics or our relationship with China or what the financial markets look like right now?
Yeah, you know, and I agree with you, Caroline. I don't want to talk about the markets where everybody else is repeating the same thing, but I would just the basic premise of what's happening in the world is that we have a level of indebtedness that is just astronomical. You know, if you look at the Western countries and all the major economies, we just have a tremendous amount of debt. And just to put it in perspective, the U.S. has alone $18 trillion in debt that we document. And then we have, I think, the latest numbers I've seen is if you take Social Security and other pension benefits that are not put on the book, the U.S., which are called unfunded liabilities, you're talking about something in the neighborhood of over $40 trillion. It's just a number that's just beyond comprehension, and there's no real, you know, there's real no capacity to pay it. Japan is not much different. The Eurozone is not much different. Greece is not much different. And China has accumulated a lot of debt in a different way, but they have accumulated a lot of debt as well. And so, you know, all that you're seeing now is that in the history of money, there's never a story, there's never a happy ending where countries consume as much as they want and it ends well. So really, I don't know if this is going to be the one that kind of puts everything over the edge, but clearly we're not far away from what I call a financial reckoning day. And the gist of really what's happened, just so everybody has just kind of a general perspective, is that all the markets globally, aside from the U.S., have been very poor, especially the equity markets. And what's happened is that the U.S. dollar has gotten very strong, and so currency is being devalued. And so what everybody's trying to do is, since they have a weak market, they want to make their product as cheap as possible compared to everything else. They just want to cheapen the value of their assets. But what they do is they devalue the money, and that's what happened in China. They devalued the currency, and so in essence, what happened is that it shocked the market. And we're beginning to see the ramifications of this devaluing of their currencies. And so I think that's kind of the first foray of what we're going to see. James Rickards and there's a lot of other financialists have commented is that really we are in what they would call a currency war. Basically, the countries and economies of the world are trying to make their money as cheap as possible so they can export their way out of it. So that's a very simple explanation, Carol. There's obviously a lot more, but I'm just trying to highlight the big broad strokes of what I think is happening right now.
Steve, before I just segue into the energy of money or some of the foundational stuff here, what is the likelihood or what is the likely outcome of a money war and them trying to export their way out of things?
Well, that's what we're seeing right now is that this is what happens is that I think it ties into the energy of money and the principles behind sound money. The principles behind sound money is that you don't consume, you don't cheapen the money base, the money supply of what it is. And really, in its essence, money is just a form of exchange. It's really what it is. And ideally, in an ideal world, the money doesn't fluctuate much because all we're doing is we're more interested in is, I want to sell you a car and you want to buy a car. And all we're doing is we're using money as a means of exchange. But what happens when money becomes unpegged from a base of something, you can print as much money as possible. So in essence, what most people don't realize is that money used to be held to a standard. Money used to be held by reserves or a gold standard where you could exchange, for example, before the 1970s, you could take your dollar bill, and you could go into a bank and exchange your dollar bill for a piece of gold, a percentage piece of gold. So there was something that was physical, tangible, and rooted to the base of money. And so getting back to your question, once you unroot or once you debase the currency where the currency is really just a means of a government's ability to print, You take away the actual value, the actual meaning of money. And so people get spooked and people get concerned about it because they realize that very quickly they can go bankrupt. The country can go bankrupt. So it becomes a very dangerous signal for the market.
So I've been referring to it, and I wrote about it today in my blog post on our blog, AboveTheFrayPodcast.com, that it's like monopoly money or it's like chips in a casino. You lose all sense of perspective when you're playing with basically imitation money. And when you print money, it seems to me, when you print money endlessly that has no, as you say, no reserve backup value, as in when we used to have a gold standard, which gold backed our dollar, then in essence you lose all perspective for what money is worth. Because you're basically playing in that fantasy or imitation world where it doesn't have any real meaning. Because if you need more, if you're playing Monopoly and you need more, so you tell the bank you need more money, and the bank's usually your brother or your father or whoever's sitting next to you, in charge of the bank and the Monopoly board. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury has been acting that way. They've been acting that way for some time. And so it moves us to the fact that there's a lack of honesty, integrity, and ethics in behaving that way, whether you do it in your own personal life, whether you go into debt. I've known people that have gone into debt deliberately, ran up huge amounts of indebtedness on credit cards and with retail stores because they intended to declare bankruptcy. That was their ultimate – they had a goal. They were going to get as much as they could get. Now, the bankruptcy laws have – changed over the years, and they reach back when there's a fraudulent bankruptcy. I think it's actually 2 years. I'm not sure. It used to be 2 years. I haven't been in that realm of law for quite some time, but they could reach back 2 years, and if it seemed like you were fraudulent, they weren't going to dismiss those obligations in bankruptcy. But the point of the argument is that whether you're the Federal Reserve or whether you're an individual who is trying to game the system, there's something inherently wrong, and there's a consequence that will be paid for being less than honest, having less than integrity, and trying to game the system. So a point of reference I'd like to start with, Steve, for the remainder of the show is, you know, I always say that the Bible, it has instructive parables, it has instructive stories, whether you're in the Old Testament, the Torah, or whether you're in the New Testament. Those stories, whether or not you're religious, they have some very important and profound lessons to be learned, whether or not you believe in the religiosity behind it. And one of those interesting things from the Old Testament for me is the Shemitah year. So the Shemitah year in the Old Testament is every 7 years God said to the Israelites, you have to forgive all debt. You have to set all slaves free. You have to forgive all debt, and you have to let the fields lay fallow. So in essence, you had to let the fields recover from farming. You had to let them recover for a year. You couldn't farm at all. And you had to forgive indebtedness. If someone owed you money longer than 7 years, come the Shemitah year, you had to forgive it because all debt was wiped away. Coincidentally, we are in a Shemitah year right now on the Hebrew calendar. And there are and we were in one in 08 as well. And so, because if you look at 8 and 7, it's 15. And if you go back, there's a historical tie between our calendar years and the principle that underlies the Shemitah year. And what a lot of people say who are religious, but let's just look at it also from the ethical standpoint. If you don't clean out your debt, God will clean it out for you, so to speak. And isn't that what's happening? It's wiping out the debt. It's wiping out money is what it's wiping out, because we have been unwilling, we have been resistant to cleaning up our own financial house. And like anything else in life, whether it's growing up and you don't do it at 15, instead you do it at 60. You know, I have a reference point in my head where a friend of someone I know kind of never grew up, and he just became like a big kid because he never had an adolescence. And so at 60, he got his body tattooed all over the place, and he ran around a bit like a teenager with drinking and recklessness. And all of that was because when you do things at an inappropriate time, whether it's growing up or when you do things that are inconsistent with how and when they should be done, there's always a consequence. And I think what we're experiencing, Steve, in a way, and we've talked about this in other shows, is a natural correction, not just of the market, but of humanity. It's a correction because we're so off the mark, whether it's Planned Parenthood, whether it's ISIS, whether it's the Federal Reserve, whether it's the World Bank. I don't really care. I just think we're so out of alignment with what life is supposed to look like. And I don't mean our personal lives. I mean the planet, life on the planet as conscious beings, that the system is correcting itself. And like any other correction, when it's done at an inappropriate time, because it wasn't done at the appropriate time, it's nasty. And I think that's what we're in. We're in the beginning of a nasty global correction.
Yeah, Carol, you bring up an interesting point, is that, and a lot of economists have said it, is that bankruptcy is not necessarily even a bad thing. There's things that get out of whack, And I want to address two points. The first one was in 08, where they had a chance to clean the system up, and they didn't. And the financial system is a little bit more complicated, but I'll give you the base example that I think really is relevant, is the bankruptcy of GM that was not allowed to take place. And what they did is that the company was inefficient. Essentially, they just had too many liabilities in terms of what they were paying the pensioners and what they were paying the workers. And in addition, they had just bad cars. They were selling bad cars. And here was a chance where they could have rewritten the contracts, fired a lot of people, made it a smaller company, and started all over again. And that never took place. So what happened was they just gave the money back to the employees. They basically gave no money back to the creditors. And so the company now exists in the same shape, way, or form that it did, 7 years ago before it went bankrupt. And consequently, it's going to go bankrupt again. so the cleaning process never took place. So a company, for example, that was $100,000 never got a chance to go back to $20,000 and had a chance to build it. So that was what happened now. That the excess have been cleaned out.
Steve, you're cutting out. Steve, you're cutting out. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, go ahead. I think it just got better.
So the excesses never got cleaned out. And so I think, like you said, we're going to go through a period where the excesses, at some point, they will be cleaned out. Part of the problem is that we just have so much debt that's now outstanding all over the world. It's going to be a painful process of how we clean out these debts. And the second point that I want to bring up is that through these excesses, what we have now is since we, in your basic economics book or whatever you want to pull it up, there's an intersection in your first class of economics where supply and demand meet, and that tells you what the price is going to be of a certain good, where supply meets demand. It might be a dollar. But what we have right now globally in the world is we have an excess of money in the world because all the countries have printed it. So what we now have is we have a supply problem with all this money that's circulating. And so what's happened is that people and the market players no longer can realize what the demand side equation for me, what that means. So think of it this way. There's just so much money circulating out there. They're willing to put into all these side projects because the signals of the market to tell you what the price should be are not there anymore. So people are just allocating capital left and right. And a lot of projects are going to go under. They're going to go bad because it's not the right price to do it. It's just the basic fundamental laws of supply and demand. And so what happens is this excess money, this excess supply, and not cleaning out the system, all it's doing is creating more supply, more problems, and the bankruptcies and the destruction afterwards are going to become much greater.
Steve, before I segue to the 2016 election and how this relates, let me ask you a question. I heard something today. I don't even know if you know the answer. I heard they're issuing mortgages again with only 3% down. Why would they be doing that?
You know what? I have not heard that, but nothing surprises me anymore. A lot of what I have seen on some of the messages is that the laws that were in place before regarding the equitable housing, meaning that you have that banks are still subject to the laws that they have to have a certain percentage of mortgages to minority people. You want to understand those laws are still in place, and so I'd imagine that a certain percentage of those mortgages are still going to have to go to people that don't qualify for them, unfortunately.
Really, unfortunately, because that's what took us down in the subprime mortgage fiasco. Okay, so as we think about ethics and values and principles and using money correctly, and we look around and we see what's happening, which is people panic when you get days where the market loses 500, 600 points, and there'll be days ahead of us where it may lose more than that, and there may be several, consecutive or non-consecutive days where the total loss turns out to be 50% of the market. Who knows? So the cheap and easy way for people to look at this is to say, because we are an instant gratification society, we need somebody who can fix the economy because that's our problem. And therefore, Donald Trump looks really appealing. How could he not? He's the guy, he's the business guy. He's the guy who knows how to cut the deal. He is the art of the deal maker, right? And he has all this wealth, $10 billion allegedly of his own. So it becomes really simplistic, I think, for people to say, well, he's our answer. Because as we point out in Money, How to See It, How to Get It, How to Keep It, and as we both know from our own lives, it's never about the money per se. It's not about how much money you have or how little debt you have, although there's a way to live life with integrity as well in your financial life, which is not to have a lot of debt, ideally not to have any if you can, but to have manageable debt proportionate to your cash flow, to your inflow. But there's a point where it's not about the money. We have so many cultural problems, and the culture is the underpinning of the economy. It's not what gets built on top of the economy. The culture has to be there first. The sense of connectedness to one another. The pilgrims and the early frontier people, they didn't get where they were going and accomplish what they were accomplishing and build towns in the middle of completely undeveloped and uninhabited areas because they acted as individuals. They pulled together and they acted as one. So we don't have that anymore. Both the technology and just the rugged individualism, I guess you would say, that has become isolation in America, what used to be rugged individualism, but now is really separation and isolation. We have all these cultural problems that underlie the economy. And my concern is that in 2008, when we knew that we needed change in our country, we bought a bumper sticker without ever asking what does change look like to the guy who was selling the sticker. Now, we're, I think, potentially on the verge of going into 2016 with that same kind of narrow, head in the sand, I want somebody to fix this for me mentality, which is, well, if we just get Donald Trump or somebody who knows business into the office, then everything will be okay. And I think that we are foolish not to think that the cultural problems, the separation, the cries of racism, the 55 plus million abortions will continue, the lack of press about the Planned Parenthood disclosures. I don't know if you saw this, Steve, but as an aside, and I know I'm throwing a lot out there and I'll stop after this, but as an aside, a satanic group was picketing in favor of Planned Parenthood. I just found it so hysterical because who would you least want picketing and supporting you than a satanic group? But of course, why wouldn't a satanic group support Planned Parenthood? They're all about murder. Now, I know it's an aside, and it's kind of my bandwagon that I've been on for a while, which is get rid of Planned Parenthood and stop abortion as a method of birth control. Perhaps stop it altogether, but that's another show. So let me just turn it over, Steve, and ask you how you feel about the need to address much more than simplistically how do we fix the economy and who can do that.
Yeah, you know, Carol, you touched on a point that I think that most economists really get is that there has to be trade has to be a measure of value for value, and the value for value means creating a product that's reliable, that works, has value to the person. That there has to be an underlying basis for that trust. And if you can look at just financial markets. You know, for example, for many years, the stock market and the bond market still does, it operates on your word. You can close, you know, multi-million-dollar transactions just by your word. And the market recognizes that contract done over the phone is a contract. And I think what happens when in the market is that, you know, the best example I can give you was that I think shook everybody to the core was the accounting scandal of the 2000s, where
Steve, slow down a bit because I'm not following you. Go ahead. Go back to what the best example is.
It was the accounting scandal of the 2000s, where Enron, for example, and many other companies, the stock market would value, for example, Enron and I can't think of it, you know, WorldCom at a certain value. We'll just say it's $100 per share, and it was based on what Enron reported. And what the accountants could prove that was true and just. But what happened was Enron and many other companies falsified and lied about what they were earning to make more money. And so what happened during that time is the market collapsed because people no longer could trust anybody's reports on the accounting situation because nobody knew who was lying and who was telling the truth. So the whole underpinnings of the market during that time period got really undermined because how do you have a market or how do you value anything if everybody lies about what they're doing? And unfortunately, I think when you don't go through some of the bankruptcies, when you don't go through some of these processes to clean out the system, it gets worse and worse. There's been, I posted an article on the blog about this, about some of the shenanigans that people have come to realize in China as well. And I think part of the market collapse that's taking place right now is that there's an element of unbelief or untruth that the market is now coming to terms with, that they can't really value what a lot of the assets and a lot of the values of Chinese companies have. And that's another thing that puts a blow to the system. Getting back to your point, that's how our market, that's how business works. There has to be a system of belief, there has to be a system of trust, and there has to be a system of honesty that people are going to do what they say they're going to do for a market to work and function. And I think that's the cultural rot that you're talking about. And until we get to the root of that and change the culture, not the laws, but the culture itself, we're always going to have these problems. And I think that's really what we're facing right now. It's kind of a crisis in our fellow human beings.
So that's what concerns me most about Donald Trump, what you just said. You are absolutely right. When people don't trust the markets, you don't have the kind of give and take or flow or value for value that you should have. It's the same thing. The phenomenon with Donald Trump is that people don't trust the politicians either, because they've lied to them to the point of beyond the point of being able to salvage themselves any kind of belief, any kind of trust. So he comes along and he sounds really, I'm in your face, this is the way it is, and people they're craving that. Here's the danger. If you look and listen to him, he will tell you that up until he ran, up until a few months ago, he was a player in that corrupt system. He got where he is by paying off politicians, by playing the game. And while you could argue, well, that's the only way it could be done, I would say to you, no, that's the way he chose to do it. He was corrupt. Knowingly, willingly, and he reveled in the fact that he bought these politicians. I don't want a guy in the presidency who doesn't have ethics, who has expediency, meaning if it works for me in the moment, fine. Well, guess what? Those are the kinds of people who you don't want making that 2 a.m. decision when the phone rings and the president has to decide, because that's situational ethics. I want to know not what will he do in the moment when it benefits him or the country. I want to know what he believes in, what he's made of, what his ethics are, what his principles are. Does he rely on the Constitution? Does he rely on the Bible? What are his anchors that cause him to be the man that I'm going to put my faith and trust in, that when the call comes at 2 o'clock in the morning, he's going to make the just, the ethical, the right, and of course, obviously, the most protective and best decision he can make for the nation. I'm very concerned that people are not looking deep enough once again, and in our desperation, in our need for a quick fix, which is what we are, we're a nation of quick fixes, we're going to choose wrongly again. And as I said in my post today, there are only so many get-out-of-jail-free cards when you play Monopoly, and I think we're out of all of our get-out-of-jail-free cards, and I don't know how many more bad choices for president we have left. I don't think we have any, quite honestly. So we've got less than a minute. So, Steve, I'm going to close it out here. I want to thank everyone, as always, for joining us here. Our audience is growing, and we thank you for that. We're here to help you. Anytime you want to call into the show, we'll take your call, and glad to hear your thoughts. Remember, our website is abovethefraypodcast.com, and Steve and I will be back here again on Thursday evening, 6 p.m. Central, 7 Eastern. Until then, I'm Carol Gold.
I'm C. Clark.
Thanks for joining us. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Above the Fray with Carol Gold and Steve Clark, from politics to the divine. Thanks for being a part of a new way to see the world. Visit our website at abovethefraypodcast.com. and like us on our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/AboveTheFray Podcast. This has been Carol Gold and Steve Clark, taking you always above the fray.